This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
So we are beginning a study of the Eightfold Path. And as I mentioned on Sunday, we'll carry this into through the fall and into the winter, assuming I hold up. you know, one of the things about these teachings about the Dharma is that, particularly the very foundational teachings, is that we can engage them and need to really engage them wherever we are. And so if we're at the beginning of our practice and really beginning to develop understanding, first encountering these teachings, then we can do that. We can access them at that level. And then all throughout our own path, our own development, these teachings continue to be foundational, to be essential, and will continue to teach us and guide us and hopefully inspire us and and also confirm. I mean, that's one of the functions of the teachings, is to inspire, to instill faith, to guide us in understanding and also into practice itself, and ultimately to be confirmed that the teachings are, through our own experience, discovered to be true. And in a sense, that happens over and over and over again. In that the way in which they are confirmed by us as our practice develops, keeps developing. In a way that the earlier insights or understandings are not made invalid, but are rather just made deeper and more clear. And we also see into the into the breadth of the teachings, that in the beginning we may be more inclined to see things in a more specific kind of nature. So the teaching of suffering is about suffering, dukkha. But as we continue to practice and study and develop, we begin to see how encompassing that is. And in a sense, how much is present within that teaching, and in a certain sense, how much we need to understand as we continue so that we can really understand that teaching. So what I want to do tonight is to begin with the Four Noble Truths. And so as you probably mostly are aware, when the Buddha came to his awakening, he spent a fair amount of time at what is now Bodh Gaya. In fact, there's a small temple just to the side of the main temple, which is quite large, which is in front of, depending on, well, as you enter, is in front of the Bodhi tree, the tree. And it's not the original tree, but it's cuttings from the original tree. And up until, I think, not that long ago, you could go right up to the tree. Now it's fenced in. Poor Bodhi tree is in a little cage. But otherwise, it would be revered to death. And so it's probably for its own good. but there's a temple to the side where it said the Buddha stood, sort of was in this space, just reflecting on his experience, on his enlightenment. And sort of we can only imagine, given the depth of his realization and also the depth and breadth and power of his mind, how he might have been sort of taking in that experience and all those experiences, actually, because it was a whole night of realizations. And I would imagine reflecting on them and also beginning to, contemplate how he might speak of these experiences. And as you remember, in his own words, the teachings that come down to us, he decided that he first decided he would not teach, that he would, he felt that people were too enchanted and enamored with their attachments and just too kind of caught up to be able to, that they, no one would be, in a sense, interested. No one would be able to hear him. And he said it would just be exhausting to try. And in the sutra, Brahma, this heavenly being, comes and appeals to the Buddha. And whether the Buddha was visited by a deity or whether that was his own internal dialogue, he was appealed to consider all of those people who could hear him, who would want to know what he had experienced, who would want to receive such teachings. And so he began to contemplate who might that be. And so first his mind went to the two teachers that he had studied with, each in turn, who had their own communities and were well-known teachers at his time, and had well-established communities, and with whom he studied and, by his own account, accomplished their teachings and realized their understanding and was invited to share in the leadership of those respective communities. And he decided, he said no, he didn't want to do that because he knew within himself that he was not yet liberated. He had not yet accomplished what he was seeking. That what he had experienced was, in a sense, perhaps what he would build upon, but that what it was still conditioned. It was a provisional, in a sense, experience because it was based on what he was doing with his mind, and he was really looking for something that was not conditional, that was not conditioned. And so then he ultimately, he went through his period of asceticism. And then he, having abandoned that as not a viable path, he took nourishment and then found his way to the Bodhi tree, which he said was a pleasant place in which to strive. And it's there that he came to enlightenment. And so he, in thinking about who he would teach, he thought about these two teachers and sort of knew through his divine eye that they were both deceased. They had already died. And so then he thought of the five ascetic, his companions that he had spent those years with studying these extreme ascetic practices. And he thought they would be ripe for these teachings. And so he set out to Varanasi, to Deer Park, to find them and begin the first turning of the Dharma wheel. And when Hojin Sensei and I and some other students were there, we got a sense of that was not just like walking down the street. That was a trek, quite a walk he underwent to get to them. But that was where he first began teaching. And he says that they shunned him, because he had rejected the ascetic path, and by their measure, he had sort of fallen over to indulgence and the attachment of pleasure. But at the same time, they saw that there was something changed in this person that they had known and practiced with for a long time. And so they eventually were moved to prepare him a seat and listen to him. And it's said that they took turns A couple of them would go out and beg for food while he taught the remainder, and then they would go out and look for food while he taught the others, and that in a matter of days they had all entered the path. And so it was the first teaching, and that was the teaching of the Four Noble Truths. And so let's just begin there. The Buddha said, and he spoke about this throughout his whole life. He referred to these teachings in many different ways, very directly, and then in ways that were very complex, in a sense, in all the different ways that he looked at these four truths. And one of the scholars that I was reading said that the more accurate meaning would be that the Pali Sanskrit term for the Four Noble Truths is four truths known by the spiritually noble. And as part of that is the noble Eightfold Path, that path, the Eightfold Path, which is followed and practiced and realized by those who are noble. And so the Buddha, just a few of his comments here, he said, whatever fully enlightened Buddhas in the past fully awakened to things as they really are, they fully awakened to the Four Noble Truths as they really are. Whatever fully enlightened Buddhas in the future and in the present came to full awakening, did so because they came to full awakening of the Four Noble Truths. That's what they were enlightened to. And he said, therefore, apply yourself to understand this is dukkha and make an exertion to understand this. This is the origin of suffering, of dukkha. Make an exertion to understand that. This is the cessation of suffering. You must apply yourself to understand this, and this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. And it's important because there are so many teachings, and he taught for so long, that what he said in the beginning and all the way through his life was this: what I teach now, as before, is suffering and the cessation of suffering. So all that he taught, all of those hundreds, thousands of teachings that he gave over all of those many, many years, were all based in this: the nature of suffering and the cessation of suffering. That is the project, if you will, the Buddhist project. And so the first of these truths is dukkha. And the Buddha said dukkha should be known. And so each of these Four Noble Truths, there is an engagement that is to be undertaken. And so the dukkha is to be understood. Craving is to be abandoned. Nirvana is to be realized, and the path is to be practiced. And so each of those sort of brings our attention to the sort of the activity, if you will, of each of these, which just underlines the sense of Buddha Dharma as path. A path is something that we engage. It is a process, if you will. Even though that word I think in English is problematic for various reasons, it's also apt for other reasons. And so the Buddha said, the cause by which dukkha comes into play should be known. The diversity, the multitude, the vastness of what dukkha is should be known. The result of dukkha should be known. What is the effect of dukkha? And the cessation of dukkha should be known, as well as the path. And so the Buddha said in terms of, and he said this over and over again in many, many sutras, the same, he characterizes dukkha in a similar way. He says, birth is dukkha, aging is dukkha, death is dukkha. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, and despair are dukkha. Association with what is not loved is dukkha. Separation from what is loved is dukkha. Not getting what is wanted is dukkha. In short, the five clinging aggregates or dukkha. And so, dukkha is very often translated as suffering. It also means disappointment, dissatisfaction. One Theravadin scholar, teacher, monk uses the word stress and has a whole, Thanissara, I believe, uses that term and has a whole rationale for why he thinks that is appropriate. So there are a lot of different, some different ways in which this is translated. And all of those terms are really trying to sort of capture, if you will, sort of encompass all that dukkha is. And so suffering is very captivating, right? Gets our attention. And we can relate to it. And so in that way, it's true and it has power. It can also, though, limit our sense of what dukkha is, right? Because we tend to think of suffering in particular ways. Each of us has particular ways of thinking of suffering, and then a whole host of things that we wouldn't consider as suffering. And in that way, it's limited, because what the Buddha said about dukkha is that all conditioned existence is dukkha. And for something to be conditioned means that it doesn't exist on its own. And nothing exists on its own. Nothing exists autonomously. Nothing comes into being under its own power, exists under its own power. And so the breadth of this first truth is that everything that we could perceive, experience with any of our senses, with our mind, anything that could be known, is, according to the Buddhist realization, dukkha. Right? Again, is a source or cause of disappointment, of dissatisfaction, of suffering, of sorrow, as the Buddha says, of lamentation, of pain. And so then we have to examine, well, why? Why is that so? And so first, let me just see if there are any questions before we go into the various aspects of dukkha.
Well, you mentioned some of the ways dukkha is translated. I don't think you mentioned craving as a...
Well, craving is dukkha, but it's also the cause of dukkha. So that's really the second noble truth. But again, in that sense, anything we could experience is dukkha. So connect that back to what I was saying earlier, what the Buddha, sort of the evidence of his own journey. So when he was studying with these other teachers, and they taught him and directed him in his meditation to certain states, right, which they presented to him as liberation. So why did he reject that? And he rejected, this is before he was enlightened, but he rejected it because he already understood, and I think this is part of his genius, of the depth of his spirituality that was clearly present even before he was enlightened, that he understood that if his liberation was the result of something he was doing, it couldn't be liberation. It could have liberative qualities in those moments, right? But as soon as those conditions of that state changed, he would no longer be experiencing that which was to be considered liberation, right? So in that sense, it was a kind of conditional state or reprieve or some sort of experience, but it wasn't ultimately liberating. And that was his imperative, right? In other words, he wasn't just looking for relief, a kind of temporary relief. He was seeking some ultimate freedom that was independent or that was not conditional upon what he was doing. In other words, he couldn't be dependent upon him being in a state of meditation forever, right? Because then he was, in a sense, bound by that, and that's not free. And so then he, in a sense, realized the basis of that when he, in his enlightenment experience, where he realized that anything that can be perceived is ultimately a source of suffering. And so we have to keep going to understand why that is so. Okay. all right. So the three aspects of dukkha, and this is important because it helps us to because sometimes people say, well, you know, yes, I see that there's suffering in my life and in the world, but there's so much good. You know, so why such this emphasis on dukkha? Why such an emphasis on suffering? You know, because there are moments when I'm happy and I feel, you know, fulfilled and feel contented and, you know, there are good things. And those things are true, and those things are good. And they're dukkha, right? So in this sense, dukkha doesn't mean bad. Dukkha is a way of describing a state, a condition that is present within every condition, right? So it's not like a value judgment. It's just a description of the nature of things within our world, within the human world, right? If you look at it from the point of view of the six worlds, you'd have to encompass more than just human beings. So the Buddha said the first aspect of dukkha is birth, aging, disease, sort of the easy access points of suffering, right? So the things that you think of when you hear that word, different forms of just pain, and the sources that bring those forward in our life. And so that just encompasses all of those universal experiences that every human being has of life being a challenge, being difficult, being painful, having adversity. the second aspect is dissatisfaction, dukkha, associated with conditioned states. Okay, so let's come back to that, because that's, in a sense, the most complex, though all of these are interlocking. And the third is dukkha or dissatisfaction caused by change, impermanence. And so just think about that, you know, when there is something that is giving you some pleasure, something good, and it doesn't last. And so you just think about across the whole spectrum, from sensory experiences to positions, titles, sunsets, relationships, emotions, anything that comes and goes and causes pain in its going. And the third, and so then going back to this dukkha caused by conditioned states. So again, remember, conditioned in Western Buddhism, we use that word in two different ways that are related. We often talk about conditioning, which is kind of like socialization. You know, how we're all influenced by our experiences of family, friends, media, advertising, culture, society, experiences, memories, associations, you know, all of that. So we think of our conditioning, we kind of think of it that way. It's kind of more in a kind of a psychological sense, okay? Condition has a very particular meaning in Buddhism, as I spoke about a moment ago, that conditioned means anything that arises out of different circumstances, different conditions that are necessary Right? And so the phrase that is used over and over again is that in every moment, every experience, every perception is a result of causes and conditions. So causes relates to karma, right? So whatever I'm experiencing in this moment is the fruit of past actions, right? It's arising in this moment because in a past action, some action was taken in the past, in some past experience, some action was taken, some intentional action, which is arising, the consequence of which is arising in this moment as a thought, an emotion, a physical sensation, and so on. The conditions, causes and conditions, is that karma alone is not enough for that to be experienced, because it's being experienced here, right, by me. And so in order for me to have that experience, if it's an experience, a visual experience or an auditory experience or a mental experience, then part of the conditions is that I have to have eyes, I have to have something that I'm seeing, and I have to have consciousness. I have to have mind. I have to have mind consciousness, and there has to be an object of mind that my mind is perceiving, right? And those three aspects of perception are taking place within a physical body, right? And so there are conditions necessary for this to be happening, right? We call that good health, life, you know, all the stuff, whatever's required to make this exist in this form. So there are conditions necessary. And when those conditions begin to become insufficient, right, we get sick, right, we get ill, we're getting old, you know, we're beginning to fade. And when they're no longer sufficient for these skandhas to be present, then this ceases to be in this form. And we call that death. And so causes and conditions means both the sort of the conditions necessary for perception, but also the conditions necessary for perception to be happening within a body and mind and an environment. Okay, is that good with that? So, this aspect of dukkha is dukkha based in conditioned states, which means that every experience, every sensation, right, every perception is within it dukkha. In that sense, it has the seeds of disappointment, right? Because it doesn't last, right? Because it is sickness, old age, and death. And on a much more subtle level, because it is based in our perception. And so that means we have to look at, to understand dukkha, we have to look at the skandhas. Okay? And this is why, you know, study is important, because you know, this is sort of pulling back the skin on what the Buddha called the world, right? Which is mind, consciousness, body, everything. The Buddha said, in this very body with its consciousness and perception, I declare are the world. And the commentary to that says the world means dukkha. In this very body, with its consciousness perception, I declare is dukkha. Its arising, its cessation, and the path that leads to the cessation of the world. So in this very body, with its consciousness and perception, is both the arising of dukkha, but also the path that leads to its cessation. That's good news. Right?
Maybe it may just be the Theravadan tradition, I'm not sure, but From what I'm understanding, I've never quite understood if everything is transitory. Why are the states of jhanas even taught?
Well, because they're aspects or stages, you might say, along the path of development.
But if since they're all transitory, why would they even be encouraged?
Why
would they be encouraged?
Well, everything is transitory. Everything is impermanent. And so the fact that something is impermanent doesn't make it unskillful or untrue. It's just impermanent. Everything is impermanent.
Well, if a person theoretically, if upon your insight or realization, that's not transitory.
The experience is.
Right.
Yeah. That's why, you know, so if you look at the Buddha's teachings on the jhanas, at each step, you know, so in the first of concentrated thought, I think, is, you know, there are different aspects, different qualities. And then in the next jhana, some of those fall away.
Right.
And in the next jhana, some of those fall away.
Right.
And so it's basically expressing how those natural experiences that a person has as they're meditating and developing are an indication of their development, but are not only impermanent, but they're a dukkha in the moment that you attach to
them. I see what you're saying. Okay, thank you.
So that brings us to the skandhas, all right? And, you know, when we're first learning this, this is a lot, right? Because there's a lot of these different aspects to be aware of, but that's why there's so much repetition in the teachings, right? They come back again and back again and back again, and that's also why we, as students, need to go back to these teachings, engage them again and again and again and again, right? So that, one, we remember, you know, we develop some understanding of what these different terms mean. We have time to reflect on and kind of relate these terms and these teachings to our actual experience, right? Which in the beginning is a little hard because our experience is just beginning, right? But as time goes on, it's easier to begin to relate this to our experience. And in that way, it becomes a very nice sort of self developing, affirming, deepening process. So the skandhas, or the aggregates, this is what we chant every morning in the Heart Sutra. O Shariputra, form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Form is no other than emptiness, emptiness no other than form. Sensation, conception, discrimination, awareness are likewise like this. The Buddha said, in short, dukkha is the five aggregates. So what Shariputra is saying in the Heart Sutra is in each of those aggregates, and the aggregates are a way of talking about you, the person. The aggregates are the person, you could say. Right? That's how Buddhism understands the person. In fact, when we do a funeral, we say we're preparing to bury the skandhas. Right? So what are the skandhas? Well, the first is form. Okay, so form is the material, right? Everything that has solidity, everything that you experience as, you know, the thingness of you. Sensation is feeling. So with your senses, when you come into contact with form, right? This comes into contact with something through the eyes, through the ear, through the nose, through the tongue, through the skin, through the mind. There's feeling, right? In terms of, in the sense of contact. So think of feeling here as not, you know, we use that word in different ways too. Feeling is just the sensory experience of contact, coming into contact, right? Conception or perception, in another translation, is where the mind begins to recognize. That first moment of contact is just contact, right? In a sense, all that's known is pain, pleasure, hot, cold, right? It's just very simple, very bare. Perception is where we begin to, like, understand. We begin to recognize what this is. We using Buddhist language, we begin to note the signs of the object. The signs are the characteristics, how we recognize this as this and that as that. Okay, so think of the characteristics. So in perception, the third skanda, we're beginning to come into recognition, to know this as a thing. Okay? And so then once we know it's a thing, and based in our feeling, right? And then arising out of our natural sort of inclination and our conditioned inclination to move towards pleasure and to move away from pain, we start to form opinions and strategies and desires. We might be repelled, we might be attracted, we might love, we might hate, right? And so the mind begins to sort of elaborate on this object in relationship to me. What's it to me? Right? What do I want of this now that I know it? Right? And then finally, consciousness, which is holding the whole thing, right? Is the whole being. And arises in that moment of contact. Okay? And so so in every moment where there is perception, the skandhas are active. Okay? And so what the Buddha said is that one of the ways he talked about delusion is that we impute or project a self into the skandhas. And this is actually something that we actually need to realize in practice, is the ways in which we project the sense of me into the form, into the feeling, right? Into the perception of the object, into my negotiation of it, and into consciousness. And the Buddha said we need that delusion is I am this. This is me. This is mine. And that where that's happening is not somewhere in the ether. It's right in that process of coming into contact. And remember, this is inner and outer, right? So objects here means also everything internal, anything that you can experience within, a thought, an emotion, a sensation, a memory, a visual image, meaning. Okay? Do you want to say?
At that point where that happens, is that where the suffering is? So it's in all the things of the world, isn't it how we relate to them that causes the suffering, not because they exist?
Correct. Yeah, the suffering is not in the object. Actually, the suffering can't be found anywhere. It's not in any place. And yet we experience it as abiding somewhere. Mm-hmm. Right? I might experience it as being in you. I might experience it as being in me. I mean, that's usually where in our discomfort our attention goes, is where we experience the suffering as being, mm-hmm. as dwelling, right? Because mm-hmm. that's the cause of the problem, mm-hmm. right? If we can just get rid of that, mm-hmm. where the suffering is, then we will be free of it, which is why when we begin to experience the burden of our thoughts or of our conditioned patterns, our habit patterns, we experience them as holding the suffering. Mm-hmm. And so get rid of that. Get rid of that thought. Get rid of that emotion, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's mm-hmm. the whole idea behind suppression, mm-hmm. is if I can get rid of this, because that's where my suffering is in this difficult emotion.
Mm-hmm. And we don't know how many times, because of past karma, it's going to come and bear fruit, how many times we need to see it.
No.
Don't before it ceases.
Speculate.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I won't. I promise.
No, you will.
So the skandhas are presented linearly, as you did just now, so, and as we chant
in the Heart Sutra.
Hold it closer.
Okay. So the skandhas are often presented or chanted sequentially, perception going to consciousness. And you said we impute the self onto the skandhas or into the skandhas. Does that happen at every point along the way or at each skanda, or is that just a function of, say, discrimination and consciousness?
No, it's. I think it's a, it's in every point because the Buddha was clear that we need to see that each of the aggregates is empty of self. And, of course, this is happening lightning fast, right? So it's very difficult to see this as a process, which is why we glom on to, you know, once it's in our consciousness as pain or pleasure, we glom on to that object because we don't see the construction of it in our mind. Okay. And that's part of the function of the just speed of our consciousness, but it's also made infinitely more difficult because of our distracted mind, right? And so one way of thinking of delusion is an incorrect use of attention, or not a skillful use of attention. The Buddha said, we're talking about consciousness and all that it is, mind. And the Buddha said, what is consciousness? It is that which arises out of conditions. Without or apart from conditions, there is no consciousness. So but for all of this happening, there can be no consciousness. Right? This is the only way consciousness can arise is within the skandhas. Which means this is the only way we can know we are, right? The only way we can know the world. That's why the Buddha said, "This body, with its consciousness and perception, is the world. Is dukkha, is the self." And that's why, on this path of that is, you know, all about singularly focused on the creation and the cessation of suffering. We have to focus on where is the experience of suffering happening, right? If the Buddha was enlightened and realized, no, suffering is in objects, who knows what would have happened? It would be a very different thing. And so that's why there's so much, the teachings are so focused on consciousness, perception, senses, you know, the machinery, all of this, right? Because that, the Buddha said, is the world, is the only thing we can know. And so that is both where dukkha arises, but it's also the path. In other words, we have to use this as well. So this, we can be used by this, in a sense that's delusion, or we can use this towards our liberation. And that's what practice is. Okay, so having made clear in the First Noble Truth that life is dukkha, conditioned, all conditioned things, which is the same as life, because how else would we know life? And how else could life be other than being conditioned? The question is why? Why is that so? And so the Buddha said it is because of craving. And craving also is sometimes translated as thirst, okay? And the Buddha said it is this craving which causes re-becoming, rebirth, accompanied by passionate pleasure. And passionate here doesn't mean... Passionate means grasping, clinging, fearful, anxiety-based pleasure. In other words, it's not ultimately going to be satisfied, this pleasure. It is this craving and that is accompanied by passionate pleasure and finding fresh delight now here, now there, namely craving for sense pleasure, craving for continued existence, and craving for non-existence. And so here in this truth, we have to examine, what does craving mean? What does he mean by that? What did he see? And so sometimes he says in different sutras, he describes craving as thirst, as a kind of clinging. Sometimes he describes it as a belief based on a belief in a separate self. Sometimes he describes it as just engaging in unwholesome actions like killing, stealing, lying. Sometimes he describes it as unskillful mental states: greed, anger, delusion, jealousy, pride. So he spoke of it in different ways, but all of them basically are pointing to the same place. And here, delusion refers to, you know, which, because delusion is also often translated as ignorance, which is, I think, kind of unfortunate, you know, in English, because ignorance often means not having sort of knowledge, you know, or information. And so ignorance here does not mean smart or not smart. Rather, it means to have, delusion is to have an active misperception. It's to have a perception that is very active, but it's not based in what's true. And so it's not like, you know, when we're confused, we know we're confused. Delusion, in a sense, is being in a deep state of confusion but not knowing it, which is why it's harder. And he also talked about it as a sort of a misapplication of attention, and we might also say an undeveloped attention, in which we see things wrongly. And specifically, what he meant by that was that we see something that is actually painful, a source of pain, but we perceive it as pleasure. In other words, it's functioning at a level that we either don't see yet that it is painful, right? Because that hasn't revealed itself to us. Or even in the moment of pleasure, we don't see that there is actual pain within that or underneath that. That we look at things and or experience things as having a kind of purity, but actually they're impure. Right? They're defiled. They're not trustworthy. They're not a place to take refuge. And that we experience and look at things as being permanent when they're not. And so when we, again, rely on something in thinking that it is permanent and then it changes, then we feel betrayed. And so the Buddha described these three forms of craving in this way. I mean, these sort of characteristics of craving in this way. So let's look at the three aspects of craving that he said. So he said there's craving for sense pleasure. Okay, so that's easy, right? Well, it feels good, right? And the Buddha didn't deny that there is sensory pleasure, that there is pleasure, right? I mean, otherwise, why, as I imagine it, right, in my mind, was he invited to meals where he probably had incredible food? I keep thinking of the food that he was probably served, because if the Buddha's coming, you're not going to, like, give him leftovers. Right? You're going to give him the best you got. So if there is no sense pleasure, why bother? Right? If there wasn't sense pleasure, then why would the Buddha have partaken and appreciated that. So there's a recognition and an acknowledgement. Yes, there is that. And that's a very rich and wonderful part of life. So what's the problem with that? Why is that included as craving, which is the source of suffering?
Because you're attached to it. You want these things to continue. And
right.
You want.
And in that attachment, what are we actually attaching to?
To attach to the desire we want to grasp.
Well, think about having that wonderful meal, right? you take a bite and it's like, ah, this is so good, right? And so then you take another bite. Why? Putting just appeasing hunger aside. Why?
Yeah, you want to eat that good things. You want to have that good things. Continue to have that
sensation.
Sensation. Yeah.
You want to have that taste again. You want to have the pleasure of that taste again. So the food really becomes a vehicle, right? And nice that things worked out that way, that food tastes good, right? So we're motivated to take that next bite, right? But then it can go off the rails, right? Because it becomes unhinged from the food itself. And so it actually begins to, we're feeding something else. We're just feeding that pleasure, that sensation. And so the object becomes a vehicle, and since we use the object to really give us that pleasure, that sense pleasure. Mm-hmm.
So maybe I'm backtracking a little bit. I wanted to clarify something about suffering. It sounds like a lot of the other states are states that can come and go, or certain perceptions or sensations can come and go, and then suffering sounds like this continuous state, and I'm curious, like, you know, the way that I'm understanding it right now is like there is suffering and we're suffering, and then there's a realization experience, or somebody realizes themselves and then suffering is alleviated, and I feel like I'm confused versus like
suffering is like everything else, it's impermanent, and like our own experience of life is happening in each moment. Just as what we call ourself in life is just a moment of experience that arises and passes in an instant, too fast to see, and then another, and then another, and then another. And in that moment, all of this is present. And so, in a sense, it's born and dies in each moment. It's born and dies in each moment until it isn't born, right? Which is what practice is bringing us to. So it's not continuous in this sense that nothing is, right? It has no, it does not have its own existence. That's the whole point. I mean, we couldn't practice. Practice wouldn't be meaningless but for this. That it is an ongoing activity. And so what if it stops being active? Right? What if the processes by which this comes into being stop? Right? Or shift? And so then we have to look at what that is, which is the next noble truth.
To bring this up just briefly, mm-hmm. about the Buddha going for that meal, right, and going, oh, I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, by the way, that has nothing to do with Buddha. I'm just, you know, that's what
I mean, this, so it's a certain kind of conjecture. Because when I think of what I've read and what I know about the Buddha, it's like, this guy is so intense. You know, the Buddha was extremely intense. I mean, no music, no nada. I mean, he was on it all the time. Mm-hmm. And he came from such an ascetic place that I was wondering, like, you could say that he was going, like, say, to a meal at King Bimbisara's place. Well, he was probably going over there to talk to King Bimbisara because he was invited so that he could help, you know, the king do something around politics that would help people. He wasn't going over there for a good meal. I mean, I'm just bringing, it's maybe silly, but it's just, I'm flashing that I can't, I never see him like that. I don't see him going, oh boy, man, I can't wait for something real. I mean, that's me, but that's not him.
Well, you know? Well, I think it comes back to what Jusan was saying, was that do you think his taste buds were dead?
No. I guess, yeah.
So his body was functioning, right? And but that as he was tasting, right, he wasn't.
He was not right.
Craving.
Right.
Right.
Right. Right.
Okay.
Right.
Gotcha. So I'm gonna have to plow ahead because we're already going into the winter. So I want to make sure that we just get through these, and then we'll, you know, this, we're not leaving this behind as we go into the Eightfold Path. Right. This is the basis of the Eightfold Path, so we can come back to questions as we need to. So there is sense pleasure as craving. There is existence. So this is very important in the sense that we crave to be, right? To have life, to exist, and importantly, to exist as me in this self, and that it is that craving which through karma and desire and grasping, which basically moves this force from one moment to the next, and from traditional Buddhism, from one lifetime to the next. So the craving for existence to be, right? And I think of this a lot, you know, particularly with Jimon working with hospice and just my own experience with people who are at the end of life, who seem in all ways to be ready to die. They want to die, right? They're at peace. They've had a good life. They don't want to stick around. They're ready. And yet, the karmic body is not finished, right? The karmic body is not finished. That this body is the result of karma, causes and conditions. And so those conditions are not yet ripe for what we call death. And until they're ripe, it ain't happening. And so the strength of that force, even when the mind, right, the intellect, the desire, you know, the conscious mind says, no, I'm ready, that there is still a grasping, right, that is not yet released. And so that's that second form of craving. And then the third is for non-existence. And I've seen this spoken about by teachers and scholars in different ways, sometimes as a kind of self-annihilation. And so that might be in a moment where just life is difficult, and I just don't... And it's not necessarily suicidal, although in its extreme case it could be, but it could be just, I want out of this. Right? I don't want this anymore. And that sort of craving to not exist in this moment, in this state. We could also look at it as, you know, in sort of just all kinds of gradations of that, of just not wanting on some level this and the grasping at that. You could look at it also from a practice point of view as a grasping at emptiness, right? At a grasping of having let go or having realized the emptiness of the self, craving, turning that into a sort of a solid sense of something in the mind and grasping at that non-existence, right? And because as soon as existence comes back, guess what comes back with it? The whole catastrophe, right? So that craving at that, I mean, that's all of these metaphors, you know, of reaching the top of the mountain, standing on top of the flagpole, right? Being free of all of the concerns, right? And wanting to attached to that. Okay? So the craving is, because dukkha is not inert, right? It's an experience that arises out of action and activity, which is ongoing. And from a Buddhist perspective, is ongoing for eons, right? It's been going on forever. And so recognizing that it's an activity, that it's a process, that the mind, body, the psychophysical being is engaged in moment after moment after moment after moment after moment, after moment, after moment, sleeping, waking, sleeping, waking, sleeping, waking. Because there is an activity that is that we are engaged in, so what if we rest? And so the third truth is cessation, nirvana. And this is where the sort of the simile of the Buddha as a doctor, right? So first there's the recognition of the illness, dukkha. There's the cause, craving. There's the prognosis, nirvana. And there's the treatment. And so nirvana, the word itself, means to cease blowing. So the image is often used of a candle. That moment after moment it's burning, right? And whether it burns for 5 minutes or 5,000 years, this candle, right? That flame is not the same, but it's not different. Right? So the Buddha used that as a way of talking about the sense of self. Right? Is it the same or is it different? And so cessation is, it has that sense of the flame goes out. And here the flame, and this is where, you know, the teachings, particularly in the texts that I suggested, these are Theravadan teachers who are teaching the traditional classical Theravadan teaching of the Four Noble Truths, okay? There are some different, larger, from a Mahayana perspective, we might say, ways of understanding these teachings, each of them. And it certainly is true with the understanding of nirvana. And so the Buddha spoke of nirvana as the cessation of the skandhas, of the afflictions, of the actions that produce craving, of the mind and body that is the home of those cravings, and of the continued existence. In other words, when the process has been interrupted and is no longer burning, right? Then that existence has ceased. And this is where, in the history of Buddhism, and the Buddha himself talked about two kinds of nirvana. He talked about nirvana with remainder. And, you know, like when you're doing long division and you get that pesky remainder you got to deal with. So the Buddha said, so first of all, the Buddha said, so he spoke about nirvana in a couple different ways, often in terms of what it's not, right? And think about that. Why? Think of the Heart Sutra. Not born, not destroyed, not, you know, not stained, not pure. Because this, as soon as you say what it is, what happens? What do you want to do?
Chase it.
Huh?
Chase it.
Yeah. It's this. I want that, right? And so by negating, right, it's like not that, not that, not that, not that. The Buddha said it is the let me get to the remainder. So Buddha said nirvana is the remainderless fading away and ceasing, the giving up, the relinquishing, the letting go of that craving. of the Second Noble Truth. This is the cessation of suffering. Nirvana itself is inexpressible, right? Because it's not conditioned. This is why it was the Buddha's liberation, right? In his enlightenment, he realized that which is not a result of anything. Even though his practice brought him to that experience, the experience itself is not a result of something. It's not causal, and it's not dependent upon anything. And so the Buddha said, it is unborn, it has no origination, it's not made, it's not conditioned. Here, nirvana, there is neither the element of solidity, fluidity, heat, motion, space, consciousness, nothingness, perception, non-perception. So there's not the sense of nothingness. There's not the sense of somethingness. There's not non-perception. There's not this world. There's not another world. There's not the sun or the moon. There's no coming or going, no existing, no non-existing, no birth, no death. We can imagine why there's no existing, but why is there no non-existing? No perception? True, but there's something that...
It's not. Because it's not the other place. It's not this end. Not the other end.
In order for something to not exist, existence has to be. Right? There can't be non-existence unless there something can't cease to exist or not exist unless existence is. And so when we chant no old age and death, no end to old age and death. You know, originally I understood that to mean that sort of like the two truths. You know, there is no old age and death, which is nirvana, and you're still in a physical form, and this form will die, right? And that's true. But it's also pointed to, and I think more fundamentally pointing to, this point, that that there is no birth, there's no not birth, there's no death, there's no end to death. Right, because there can't be, you can't speak of there being no death or no end to death unless there's death. So the Buddha said, nirvana with the, so that when the Buddha was enlightened, so this is a question, right? Because he still had this, right? He still had the physical body. He was still living in his skandhas. Right? And this body, which is a result of karma and conditions. Right? And so the question was, so what was that liberation? Right? Was it completely free of suffering? And so this is what the Buddha said. Here, nirvana with remainder, here one who has lived the life, done what was to be done, laid down the burden of delusion, destroyed the bond of becoming, no longer giving rise to that sense of self which is renewed moment after moment. One who is free through rightly knowing, direct experience, as their faculties are still present, they experience what is agreeable and disagreeable, what is pleasure and pain. Sumptuous food? Not sumptuous food. The five aggregates remain. It is their liberation of greed, anger, and delusion that is called nirvana with remainder. Okay, so they're liberated. He was liberated from greed, anger, and delusion, from suffering through those poisons. Nirvana without remainder is all of that. And he said now, and he's talking now about in death, now all of one's feelings are no longer welcomed, not being delighted in, will here and now become cool. Because there's the skandhas are no longer present. The conditions to have those feelings, to delight in them, are no longer present.
You said that all other experiences are caused, but nirvana is not caused.
Right.
I don't get it.
Well, exactly. Nobody does. That's the limit. That's why it's a challenging path. That's why the Buddha almost didn't teach. How do you teach a path that in which we will relate to in the same way we relate to everything, which is I'm going to do this and I'm going to get this. I'm going to bring about certain causes and I'm going to bring about certain consequences. And how do I do that and relinquish my grasping at that very process?
I guess I thought the whole thing was cause and effect. I mean,
Well, there is cause and effect. Up to the point where, I mean, what is cause and effect is based in the skandhas, is based in form appearing. So let's go back to how do we even perceive something, right? There has to be an object of perception, I mean, an organ of perception, an object that's being perceived in consciousness. So what happens when consciousness drops away? So when the mind becomes still, right, there can still be self-awareness. The mind is not moving, right? So it's beginning to experience samadhi, but the response or the reactivity to things arriving is changed. You see it, right? You're not as reactive. Your mind, even if it does, it may bring forth a thought. You know, you may have a sort of sensory or sensation or emotional response, but it tends to be very light, right? It's getting lighter, and it dissipates very quickly. And we should note that in the same way that when we're really caught within ourself, those experiences are very strong, feel very solid, right? They last long, much longer, right? In other words, they have all of that, those qualities of solidity, of self, of autonomy, of its own existence, right? And so that you know, with even without realization, we're watching these changes, and we just delight in the changes, right? We're just happy because it's so much more of a pleasant experience. But we should also be seeing what's happening, right, and connecting it to that, what's going on in your mind, right? What are you doing? Because you're not controlling it. It's not a result of controlling. It's just the opposite. You're relinquishing your control and allowing things to be more as they are, and which means this, your mind, your body. And as that is allowed, and we're creating the possibility of that through your mindfulness and your concentration and developing more stability and constancy, then we are experiencing things more in their natural state, right? Which is peaceful. And so when we talk about in the beginning of practice not judging, you know, we're saying don't actively, try to not actively get caught in judgment, right? Because we believe in that process so much. More and more, that becomes less and less a thing, an activity, right? We just aren't responding to that thing. Now, this can take a long time, okay? But we're watching that path unfold. And so if you keep following that, even just imagining, how does that proceed when the mind is completely still, so that sense of self and other begin to merge, that sense of subject and object begin to merge. And so what's happening is, remember that karma, the activity, all of this activity within the skandhas is karmic because there's desire, there's intention. So as you're practicing, as your practice becomes more and more stable, what's also happening is your desires, your intention, even your good intention to practice and is becoming more and is starting to drop away. In other words, you're not needing to rely on those desires and those intentions to keep you on course. You know, a lot of the time we do need to do that. We need to summon that. We need to remember. We need to cultivate that. That's what cultivating bodhicitta is. But as it becomes more and more integrated, you don't need to do that as much, right? And so in that, you're creating that sort of those wheels of karma are beginning to... So, but when you said you don't get it, and I said nobody does, it can't, it, by its very nature is non-conceptual. If we could, if it was in the same realm as everything else, we could just make it happen. Right? We would just figure out how it works, and we would use our mind to make that happen. That's why our thinking mind is so powerful and we so cherish it, is because we can make things happen, right? And so, and nirvana isn't cost. And so that's why practice, you know, when Dogen talks about forgetting the self, he's really saying allow your practice to become, you know, develop your practice so it becomes so stable to the point where you forget practice, you forget intention, you forget object, you forget striving, you forget nirvana. Okay?
This might be a different turning, but when we chant Kanzeon at one with Buddha, related to all Buddhas in cause and effect, mm-hmm. so relating to a Buddha that's beyond cause and effect via cause and effect...
Or relating to a Buddha,
yeah.
is certainly in the realm of cause and effect.
And
as long as we're relating to something.
Yeah, and I'm wondering what if we're trying to get beyond cause and effect conditionality, why reference relating to Buddhas via cause and effect?
Because that's where practice occurs. Practice occurs. I mean, that's what I was saying. Is everything, every moment in which practice is happening within us, we are creating karma, right? Because there is intention, there's self-awareness, there the skandhas are present, right? But we're creating a karma that is freeing or relinquishing, you know, our grasping, our craving, right? And which results in the diminishment of dukkha, which is the experience we have when our life begins to change. So let me just, because we're running out of time here, I want to just mention a couple of things. So the Buddha really talked about extinction, right? The extinction of desires, the extinction of these afflicted states of mind. And in Mahayana Buddhism, you know, Nagarjuna, for instance, said that there's not the slightest distinction between samsara and nirvana. They're one truth. They're undivided. Whereas in the early teachings, there was a sense of liberating oneself from samsara, you know, renouncing the world, leaving the world of the dusts. You know, this is why the Buddha said to his monks, don't dance, right? Because in that, and don't have sex, right? And don't sleep on high beds. And because that meant something back then, right? Because all of those things were pathways back into activating all of that craving and those desires. And what the Mahayana teachers and Nagarjuna and all this whole legacy of teachings is that, but the skandhas are the path to liberation. They're not just the path to liberation, they are liberation itself. They have the same nature. They are unconditioned. And so... And so Nagarjuna says, whatever is dependently co-arisen, okay, we talked about that earlier, which is everything, everything in the universe, that is explained to be emptiness. The nature of that is emptiness. That being a dependent designation, right, something we call emptiness, is itself the middle way. Even the reference to, even the name, is itself the middle way. Its nature, too, is empty. It does not have the capacity to bind. Right? A desire itself does not inherent within it have the capacity to bind us, because it has no inherent quality. It's all happening within the realm of the skandhas. Something appears. I touch it. I feel it. I recognize it. He goes on to say, something that is not dependently arisen, such a thing does not exist. Such a thing has never appeared. Therefore, a non-empty thing does not exist. There's nothing that does not have this nature. And I want to end with a teaching, a dialogue in a sutra that I came across, which I thought was nice. The Buddha once asked, when the sun rises in the east and the sun ray comes through the window of a house, where does it land? And the student says, on the western wall, master. And the Buddha said, and if there is no western wall, where does it land? And the student said, on the ground, master. And the Buddha said, and if there is no ground, where does it land? And the student said, on the water, underneath the ground, master. And the Buddha said, and if there is no water, where does it land? And the student said, it does not land, master. And the Buddha said, in the same way, when there is no clinging to form, to feeling, to perception, to mental formations, and consciousness, to the skandhas, then consciousness cannot land. Not landing, it cannot grow. Not growing, it cannot become. And I thought it was a nice analogy, you know, for just how when you sort of just keep sort of letting the wall fall away, the ground fall away, the water fall away, there is nowhere for it to land. And practice is essentially practicing all of those landing places. Okay? So the rest of our meetings will be taking up the fourth noble truth, which is the path. Right? Because without this, now what? Right? So, and we'll just go through these in sequence because the sequence is important. And so I hope that all of you are doing this in concert with some reading. Okay, that's really important, is to take in the teachings. And it's quite wonderful that these teachers from these books that are recommended are all online. They make them, it's part of their dana, is to make them publicly available. And so please do, and study them. Take time, reflect. Really try and understand what's being said, and if, you don't have to limit yourself to these texts. There's lots of teachings on these, and if possible, and these the translations of the original teachings are largely online. Not all of them, so each of the traditional collections, the Connected, the Middle Discourses, the Short Discourses, and so on. They're all online, but not every sutra has been translated. And so sometimes you might go looking for one and it's not actually there. But there's a lot there. And it's good to become familiar with the Buddha's actual teachings, because that's as close as we can get, to what he actually said and how he presented it. Okay, so thank you, everybody. Can we end with the four vows? I just want to mention, tonight I needed, there was a lot to cover, and so I did that. I'm hoping and intend that in the other meetings, because we'll be focusing just on each of these paths, we'll be able to take a lot more questions and have more discussion. And it would be nice, Hokyu, I don't know if, is this live streamed or just recorded? live stream. There's no a way of having people send in questions or. Okay. people could also be encouraged to, when we send out the announcement, of send in questions ahead of time. That might be a little easier to manage. Okay, thank you.
Thanks for listening. You can find more Dharma Talks, interviews, and events at zmm.org/media. While online, please check out the Jizo Project, our multifaceted initiative to make Zen Mountain Monastery more accessible and welcoming to all. Learn about the new Jizo House building and accessibility enhancements to existing facilities that are just two aspects to this exciting endeavor. Find out more and see how you can get involved at zmm.org/JizoProject. That's JizoProject.